Based with the London, from Lynx, right. And here for EuroISPA. So we have a range of different perspectives from the private sector, from an ISP association, a user perspective, intergovernmental perspective, and then a background paper and video that kind of sets the scene for the discussion later on. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Chad, who wants to make some introductory remarks about the video, and then we will screen the video and proceed from there.
To introduce to you Namita Malhotra, who is from the Alternatives Law Forum. It's it's a non-government organization based in Bangalore, and they have been working around issues on the internet and regulation. So Namita could not be with us because of visa problems, but what we've asked her to do is try to present a video. The sound quality is okay, but you'll need to be a little bit patient because there are ambient sounds of rickshaws and street sounds from Bangalore. So there will be it's about 20 minutes, and we have the paper there, so we'll see how we go with this. But I'll leave it there.
Yep.
There are more people watching this video in Rio than there are people watching me here in India, because here I have just had my two colleagues and a videographer that I just met today. And this might even be in some way symbolic or indicative of how there is a difference between the laws in different parts of the world and the space that is available to raise issues around content regulation in the Indian context vis-a-vis international forums and other forums. I'm going to jump directly to talking about content regulation and the one thing that people seem to agree about when it comes to content regulation, which is child pornography. Whether it's NGOs, international bodies, state governments, women's organizations, child rights organizations, and various other players, including the Christian right or other conservative groups. So one thing that there seems to be agreement upon is that we have a problem with child pornography. This kind of agreement in some sense obscures other kinds of issues, that women face harassment and even violence in cyberspace, that there are images of sexual humiliation and torture of detainees and prisoners of war that are circulating through the internet, or any other kind of content that people would have problem with is subsumed within the fact that we all agree that we have a problem with child pornography, and that in itself seems to indicate that we also have a consensus with how child pornography should be dealt with, that there should be state mechanisms and legal mechanisms, including international laws, that deal with child pornography. The problems of a debate that is solely configured around this category are many, and I hope to outline a few here today. One of the problems that arises is that such a debate automatically assumes that content is static and dead as an object, that parts of it can be blocked or erased, and that's the imagination of content with which the law has to work. But the reality is that 2% of the internet, that 2% of net content consists of adult websites, but this fraction is highly visible and accounts for a significant amount of the web traffic. This is because even though only 2% of actual content is about adult content or sexual content, the traffic is about webcams, chat rooms, peer-to-peer file exchanges, unsolicited email, etc. And a significant amount of the traffic is also non-commercial. Thus, content regulation mechanisms that focus on content as a static object might end up doing very little to address the problem of child pornography, because there is a basic misunderstanding of what content is and a refusal to acknowledge that internet and technology are changing sexual practices, and that net pornography or internet pornography is about a set of practices and behaviors around sexual sexuality and not just static content. The debates also seem to ignore that the desires and sexuality of the child himself or herself, and a simplistic way to reduce the child to a non-sexual or non-curious being, which if any of us remember our childhood should know that that is completely untrue, and that such behavior of the child can be controlled or should be controlled by the state, school, and the family. Paradoxically, other international laws like the Convention on the Rights of the Child acknowledge that the child has a certain degree of autonomy, a right to receive information in different media, including art, the freedom to seek and impart information without arbitrary and unlawful interference. But most regulations around child pornography and most filtering software promoted by corporations completely ignore this aspect of the autonomy of the child. The debate also lacks participation of voices from different perspectives, and this is also most evident from the fact that I am not there because of visa problems, which is because of various fuck-ups, because of the first world not allowing us to transit directly to other places in the global south. There also is a perceived lack of feminist intervention or even women's voices. For instance, the debate around .xxx as a proposed domain, or .kids as a proposed domain, or CP80, which is the community port 80 idea that has been suggested. And all these suggestions about creation of a different domain or the zoning of the internet are taking place without much being said by women's organizations, women's group, or especially from a feminist perspective. There's no real understanding of how such as having a domain like .xxs would change how we access information on the internet, whether it would address concerns around internet pornography. Any other perspective around the issue, including a feminist perspective, is being subsumed into a larger question, a larger political question of debate of internet governance. Debates around gender in this.
Right, we've decided on a change of plan because the video is not very clear and the audio is slightly inaudible. So what we've decided is that chat will take us through a summary of the paper and some of the main points in the paper, and that we then proceed on to the other presentations and discussion.
Thank you. We're sorry about that, but you have seen Namita, and this is her work. As I said, she is a lawyer. And I want to start with the premise that most of the discussions around content regulation of the internet to date has been around the lowest common denominator of child pornography. Most of that has been, and what we are trying to bring to this forum is bringing in other voices into the discussion. The problem with a debate that is solely based around child pornography is that it does not bring into play some of the discussions, and it's an old debate within the women's movement and women's perspectives around sex and sexuality, and that's one of the things we want to bring in. The argument that Namita presents is that net porn is not, or pornography is not static object, but a set of practices and behaviors around sex and sexuality. So that is the basis for most of the arguments of the paper. And we have copies for you here. The debate also lacks participation, as we said, from voices from different perspectives. There also seems to be a perceived lack of feminist intervention and even women's voices. At the same time, it has to be acknowledged that women's movements and feminists in different parts of the globe have realized the difficulty of appealing to the state for protection, as this often doesn't work in their favor, and works to suppress the voices of women themselves, to clamp down on spaces for the expression of alternative sexuality, to limit the spaces for networking and interaction between women. Therefore, from a feminist perspective of the debate around net porn and content regulation has to first begin by understanding the historical meaning and significance of the category of pornography, the definition of pornography, rather than speaking abstractly about terms such as obscenity, indecency, to fix these terms to their meanings in different contexts, both historically and in different parts of the world. So what is pornography? As said before, very different kinds of media, activities, and behaviors are being collapsed into the category of pornography. This ranges from hentai porn, sexually explicit video and images of people, comic porn, erotica, explicit art, cyber sex, webcam sex, chat rooms, etc. Part of the problem is the imagination of internet porn as static and dead content for the convenience of regulating it, when it consists largely of interactive conversations, activities, and behavior. Further, in most countries, pornography as such is not defined. What is obscenity or standards of indecency? Hence, pornography is further collapsed into the category of obscene. One of the things that Namita did research is around how what determines standards of obscenity, and she says that in most Commonwealth countries there is the Hicklin test. Hicklin and she describes this as a case of judgment a judgment in R.V. Hicklin, in this case, which was about the mass distribution of inexpensive pamphlets of how priests extract erotic confessions from penitent women. Rather than obscene, the pamphlet's purpose for publishing and distributing it in large numbers was to discredit the Catholic Church. Hence, the question that arises, obviously, is whether its banning was connected to the political meanings of the pamphlet or its alleged obscenity. Historically, the first usage of the word pornography was also to ensure that only an elite group of people would have access to erotic art and material. The secret museum of Pompeii contained artifacts, objects, and paintings which were erotic and sexual, that only men of a certain scholarly interest were allowed access to, and not the easily corruptible rabble, women, and children. Though pornography is mostly about the pleasure of heterosexual male and leaves out women's subjective experience of pleasure, it can't also be so easily dismissed as a form of violence degrading to women. I think what she is trying to say here is that there is complexity in looking at content and what is considered as pornography, and one has to look at how it has historically been defined, what actually, who defines pornography and how it is defined. And that there has been, that pornography has also been, paradoxically provides one of the few free spaces for the expression of counter-hegemonic representations of sexualities and desires. So she then goes on to look at how does law function in relation to regulating pornography. The law either functions in an instrumental sense to govern society, consisting of norms that are independent and exist outside the framework of everyday lives of people, and these laws are instrumental in how people relate to each other. Or in an organic sense, laws that emerge from the everyday practices of people and are already part of interactions between people. What she's saying is that the current regulation of pornography sees pornography as static, and that one of the things that she looks at are some alternatives in looking at practices that can define what is acceptable content, what is harmful content. And that's where the framing of how then do we look at content regulation. And I won't go on to... I leave you to read some of the examples that she presents there, but that she looks at a number of models in terms of models of content regulation. And she says that there is an obvious failure of the law as an instrumental or constitutive force to regulate obscenity or harmful content, either in its attempts to define it in isolation from other social and moral meanings, or in the use of obscenity laws to police sex and sexuality and encroach on freedom of expression. She cites cases, for example, in India, where in a social networking site for men, for gay men, four gay men were arrested based on content that was, because they actually organized to meet or set to meet somewhere, and they were arrested by Indian police because of that. So what she's saying is that much of the obscenity laws come from quite traditional laws that regulate current media, and a lot of that is now being brought into the internet. There is a need to turn away from finding an answer in the instrumental and constitutive elements of the law and to look at organic laws embedded in the practices of people, keeping in mind that sexual fantasy, gender, and desire fundamentally derives from mystifications, that they are mysterious workings that cannot be pinned down and regulated, and that they may not be politically correct, but fantasies are not the enemy, by definition, are based on unruly desires rather than politically correct needs. And number two, the privacy of a person, and not in the sense of a privacy of information or body as is legally defined, but privacy that turns from exclusion based on self-regard to regard for another's mysterious, fragile, and autonomy. And she describes an event called online virtual reality site where there was an incident. This is called LAMDAMOO, LAMDAMOO. It is a text-based, and this site is a text-based site and allows different players to choose gender, sexuality, and other aspects of themselves while entering. Two women who were part of this site were attacked and violated by another player, who, by running a program, was able to make them do sexual and humiliating things to themselves. The women described the act as rape, and the community accepted that the act was a grave violation that needed to be addressed. Although what should be done was cause for enormous debate in the community, eventually the offending player was removed from the community. So she cites as an example of the community self-regulating and finding, and through that practice, finding ways of then how, what is acceptable within this community. More importantly, the incident went on to become a catalyst for ballots so that anyone could put to popular vote any social scheme requiring implementation. So she describes that as one possibility, and here I'm presenting some of the alternatives that she is providing. The second is peer-to-peer monitoring, and she explains that another instance of self-regulation that seems to operate at least moderately well is peer-to-peer regulation on the popular online streaming video YouTube. The user is allowed to flag content as inappropriate, and YouTube is then compelled to check on the content to determine whether it should remain online. The obvious drawback is that the final authority is YouTube, which is a corporate entity that is not invested in maintaining freedom of speech necessarily. For instance, a stand-up comedy routine that contained references to Gandhi, originating from the UK, was uploaded on YouTube and drew widespread objections from Indians, including coverage in the mainstream news media. The video soon disappeared from the website, even though technically it was not offensive or obscene, but challenged certain perceptions or nationhood, of which Gandhi is an important symbol. Ultimately, the corporate entities being given the power over spaces for free speech and expression is more problematic than states having such power. So that's the other point. The other model that is being used is filtering software. The danger of relying on corporations is also evident in the use of filtering software, especially programs meant to protect children from harmful content. Such software often blocks content that is useful, informative, or would provide a different perspective to the child because it is deemed inappropriate, indecent, radical, etc. And we've heard, I think, there has been quite a number of sessions here looking at that and looking at its effectiveness. Moreover, while quietly restricting political speech, and this again is still about filtering software is often not effective in regulating what would probably be far more harmful content. On running a check of the various filtering programs available, it was found that objectionable websites frequently slip through. Using filtering software produced by commercial interests is beset with problems, and yet it is the solution that is suggested in most schools and universities and to families. The last point that she looks at are, in fact, going to be discussed around self-regulation by internet service providers. So I won't necessarily go into that. And I just want to read then a conclusion that she makes. The idea then is to move away from an instrumentalist and constitutive notion of law to regulation that is more organically formed from the practices of people. This could take the form of self-regulation within communities or peer-to-peer monitoring practices that may be set up by the state or corporate bodies but are not ultimately controlled by them. Though this may sound utopian, self-regulation might actually be the model that is the most practical for the internet. Self-regulation manages to address the multitude of concerns related to content regulation, the freedom of expression, including sexual expression, disparate cultural standards, and the conflicting definitions in different jurisdictions, the technological hassles of controlling gateways, and the political and administrative conundrums of controlling ISPs. The reality of cyber harassment and violence against women in cyberspace and the practices around sex and sexuality on the internet that cannot be contained within a single framework. Self-regulation is one of the only ways of ensuring that the internet remains as a free space for the expression and existence of the multiple secret worlds that are created by people, allowing for their fantasies and unruly desires to speak, to perform, and to be.
Thank you, Chad, for that. Can I invite the speakers back to the podium so we can start with the presentations? excuse me. We're going to start with Matthias Tramer and then go on to Malcolm Hattie and Adriana, and then I'll give Chat another opportunity to speak to the women's programs activities. So I'll just hand over to you.
Yes, thank you very much. Good afternoon. First of all, I really want to express my thank and my appreciation to the organizers of this workshop, that they concentrate on the question of harmful content, and that, as we have heard, it's extremely important to stress this differentiation between illegal content on the one side and harmful content on the other side. The problem is that discussions, even in workshops here, for example, when I remember one workshop yesterday, often really mix up these questions. And the problem is and I'm a lawyer, I'm a constitutional lawyer and a human rights lawyer, the problem is illegal content and harmful content touch very different legal questions, and not only legal, but also policy questions. Whereas illegal content, child pornography, some kind of heavy violence and so on, can be more or less regulated by the state, of course, with all the inefficiency and lacks of regulation problems that we know, but although they can be, let's say, controlled in a certain, at least theoretical way, harmful content is really the policy challenge, I'd say. How can we really, or what does the state, which role does the state have when there is a content which in principle is legal, but is detrimental to certain groups in society, to the vulnerable groups and so on? There will always be this conflict, of course, first of all, with freedom of expression, where you say, well, freedom of expression, of course, has to be the rule, and me as Council of Europe representative always will won't be stopping to express this. Where is space for the state to intervene? When I say now intervene, I want to stress the fact that intervention of the state doesn't always mean a top-down intervention by prohibition, by regulation, and so on. When I say state intervention, I want to stress here that by my understanding, state intervention should understand an active state and not a passive state. And when the state wants to be active, he can do this in several ways. In this context, I want to quote or to inform you about one judgment of the European Court Human Rights in Strasbourg from October 2005. It's called the Perrin, P-E-R-R-I-N, versus the United Kingdom case, because this is really interesting which role the state has have from the viewpoint of the court if the state is not does not really have the practical capacity how to deal with problems like this. First of all, the court says that content regulation as such, and this is, I think, very important, is not an end in itself, but is the result of what we would call a pressing social need in a democratic society that comes from, of course, the understanding of the European Convention on Human Rights. And when we speak about a pressing social need, this means what is really the need of society and what are the pressing needs. And in this context, it was a case that was dealing with the borderline between harmful and illegal content as regards the protection of children. The court principally stated that it is not possible to find in the various legal and social orders a uniform conception of morals, but that the view taken of the requirements of moral varies, of course, from time to time, so it's an evolutionary understanding, and from place to place. I mean, that's nothing new, we know, and that's also the reason why until today we do not have one, maybe worldwide or even not European or whatever, definition, what is pornography, what is harmful, and so on. I mean, this is, let's say, the fact. And now I come to the interesting part where I'd say in our context of this court decision. The court has stated that the fact that state regulation may provide only limited protection to vulnerable people is no reason why a responsible government should abandon the attempt to protect them. So that's what the court says. So he wants states to be active, even if they have not the possibility maybe for classical regulation. And we know the problem is classical regulation of the internet as such. One of the facts is it's the global dimension of the internet, of course, and the lack of effectiveness in the prosecution. And due to this development, we all know there has been a change of paradigm in the understanding of the state, not being so much only the regulator, but the facilitator, the coordinator, and let's say really the organization that supports vulnerable groups to solve at least some of their problems. So it's not so much the regulation that we are talking about, I think, when we talk about harmful content. Also filtering is, to my mind, only to some extent a solution. Actually, we are working in the Council of Europe on a recommendation on transparency of filtering systems, because this is one of the most difficult issues as regards the actual filtering systems that users often do not even know how this filtering system works. And of course, the line that we are following in the Council of Europe is really this question of empowerment that also your organization is always stressing. Empowerment is one of these maybe a little bit fashionable terms that are used everywhere, but nonetheless, I think it's the responsibility of especially each government to think about what can I contribute as state to empower my different groups in society, especially the vulnerable groups. I won't dare to say that women as such are a vulnerable group, but of course with all these very sad facts that we just heard again, there is of course this strong need of protection, especially in the context of ICT and certain facts that we have heard. So how does empowerment work? I think most important really is the understanding of ICT policy within a government. And I can, then I will come to an end because I don't want to speak too long. But one of the challenges that I was facing when I was preparing all these information society issues for various conferences for politicians, one of the challenges is to explain to politicians that ICT policy is not also not an end to itself. It's not, let's say, something like an esoteric technical issue, but that ICT policy must be an integrated policy of each politician who is responsible for, let's say, a certain ministry. Information society and internet governance policy means that each politician, for example, the one responsible for education, the one for culture, the one for technology, the one even for finance, the one for labor, has to ask himself, how have ICT changed my policy tasks? And this is especially also the fact for those ministers, persons of government who deal with gender and equality rights. So the danger often is, and maybe because you were asking if I can from my personal experience should do some advice, or so I wouldn't really give you an advice, but I just tell my experience. The problem that we are still facing in ICT policy as such, that it is often seen as something of extra policy. When we discuss, for example, ICT and women, yes, you often have arrogant male people who say, well, ICT and women are a good joke, and so on. And this is really the big issue, what we have to do. ICT policy is social policy. ICT policy is gender policy. ICT policy is education policy, and so on. And therefore, I'm also very satisfied how the IGF has moved in a direction, going away only from the critical infrastructure discussion, which is, of course, important, to a social dimension as such, and all these workshops that we have here. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthias. I'll now hand over to Malcolm Hutty for his presentation.
Thank you. Yes, I'm Malcolm Hutty. I'm here for EuroISPA today, and I also hail from LINCS, the London Internet Exchange, which is an association of internet service providers. EuroISPA is the body which is the umbrella group for the representative bodies for internet service providers across Europe. It's long been EuroISPA's position that freedom of expression and many other things besides are best protected and must be protected by something called mere conduit, namely by not holding the internet service providers responsible merely for traffic that passes over the network. Whatever your views on what content may be permitted or should not be permitted, whatever your views on what should be done about that, it is our contention that it is wrong to go after the internet service provider as the intermediary for the material that you consider unacceptable. If you do that, then the network has to know and understand the content that it is carrying and can only permit content to pass across the network that it does understand. Because it won't understand, the network cannot be capable of understanding things that are newly invented. Innovation stops at that point. So for the sake of technical progress and technological progress, we have to protect mere conduit. But we also need to do it for reasons of social progress. We do need to be aware when we are talking about what is acceptable and unacceptable language, what is unacceptable argument, what is unacceptable material to purvey, that when we are talking about this with regard to the internet, we are extending the area where there was effective control by the state apparatus greatly beyond what was there in the past. Because in the past, a lot of private conversations were private. The people that were there, that were physically present, are the only ones that are party to it. And so the involvement of the state apparatus to implement and to require the implementation of social policy was thereby limited. However, nowadays, when so much conversation occurs online, it is mediated. It is traceable. It is recorded or recordable. It is possible to go after the ISP and say, and to leverage the pressure that the state can bring to bear on the ISP to use them as a means of policing the network and policing the users in a way that was just never tenable except in the most restrictive regimes with regard to private conversation in the past. So for the sake of freedom of expression, freedom, self-expression, access to knowledge and all sorts, we need to give the highest regard to the protection of the ISP from that liability, because otherwise the ISP becomes a more effective policeman than could ever have been used in the past, and the consequence of that is not necessarily good. Even if the social policy has been determined with the best will and with the best and noblest of intentions, it is flawed. It is inevitably flawed, and one of the releases for that flaw is that the prosecution and the enforcement of social policy is limited, and the resources are limited and can only be applied in limited cases, and therefore there is a prioritization as to how that is done. If the ISPs are leveraged, we can look at something which is potentially far more repressive. I'd like to say a few words in response to some of the points that have been raised as well, if I may. Certainly, the point about self-regulation was brought up, and EUROSPU is a big fan of self-regulation. We believe that it is better than passing laws that firmly require ISPs to do things, because it can be more flexible and effective, and of course it can reduce the legal risk to the internet service providers, and that's who we are, so you know, it's in our interest. But we do have to recognize when we are saying how good self-regulation is and how it does make a more effective response to the pressing social challenges that we meet. At the same time, there is a challenge of transparency there. The self-regulatory mechanisms are rather prone to capture by campaigning interests. We're talking about child pornography here, so we're talking principally about the so-called child protection lobby, the child protection charities and NGOs, can be very effective, particularly by manipulating very emotive headlines and playing upon the universal revulsion that people feel for child pornography, so as to establish norms and expectations that would not necessarily survive a wider scrutiny of the kind that precisely that our opening paper was drawing attention to. So I think it's good to be mindful of that and to recognise that. I mean, there is things that occur in this space that I see within the United Kingdom around the use of language around this. I mean, for example, in the discussions that I have with government and with the child protection charities and campaign groups and that occur between industry and those groups, we're not allowed to use the term child pornography anymore. It's a term that is considered to be an unacceptable term that is said to be legitimising it. Now, I don't believe it legitimises it, but it is said to be legitimising it, and the term that we are supposed to use now is child abuse images. And that is to emphasise that this is a record of an actual child being abused, which is a fair enough argument, until the point where that language then gets extended to cover the purely fantastic. The images of things where there is no child involved, at which point one thinks that child pornography is a more accurate description of it, but we have at this point moved into the language of child abuse images, which is there, I would suggest more than anything else, to close that debate around and to support the contention that we are told in the UK by law enforcement, it is reported to us as fact that this material causes the abuse of children, that the use of this material by offenders is used to reduce their inhibitions and cause them to be more and more willing to actually carry out acts of contact abuse against children. I know that is a highly contentious proposition in an open scrutiny, but in the environment of self-regulation where the only people that are invited to the table are the campaign groups, this becomes taken as a matter of unchallenged fact. So I think that's something that's worth drawing attention to, particularly as now some of the things that we have seen We see this across Europe. The European Commission funds the child protection groups to do some very worthwhile and worthy work, and some great stuff, I should say, about the removal of the most extreme and unacceptable forms of content. But at the same time, that money is also used to advance a political agenda around this, which is not an open and transparent agenda. You mentioned before the importance of distinguishing between illegal and harmful content. And I would say yes. ISPs would say it's important to distinguish that, because if it's illegal, then we will take action against it. And if it is harmful, it is not for us as a mere provider to take a view on that. It is a matter for debate within society. I would, however, point out that the claim that the content is harmful is not a neutral claim in itself. It is an attempt to advance the agenda, that actually the only real distinction between those is that in a case of illegal content, the apparatus of the state has made a decision that this is no longer subject to arguments, that there is a decision that this is no longer acceptable. Whereas that harmful content essentially is somebody arguing that it ought to be illegal. And therefore the agenda gets advanced on that. And certainly in the self-regulatory context, there is a considerable risk that ISPs ought to attempt to resist, but sometimes find it difficult to do so, which is to not to go that bit further, because it is an open and flexible and self-regulatory regime, and to stray over into that which is harmful, or said to be harmful, and which is, by definition, there still contentious. So I would say it is our view that it is very important that we take very serious action against the very real harm that is done by those that abuse children using internet technologies. But at the same time, we have to be mindful that a lot of the so-called awareness-raising activity and campaigning activity in this area is an emotive attempt to establish norms that would not otherwise be passed so easily unchallenged. It is important that we protect our children on the internet, but it is also important that we protect an open and free internet for the sake of the children and their inheritance.
Thank you very much for that, Malcolm. I'm going to hand over to Adriana to make a presentation.
Hi. Good afternoon already. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm here with a perspective more of an end user, a Brazilian end user. So my mother tongue is not English, so I'll kind of read it. Sorry. So prohibitionist politics do not work because they go against a fundamental right, which is freedom of expression. One local example from Brazil is the criminalization of some kinds of drugs consumption. Drug prohibition has led to a parallel market in Brazil that brings with it violence and corruption. The government cannot control the drug trafficking. The police are inefficient, and the population loses out in two main aspects. Users cannot buy drugs with a guarantee of quality control, and the government cannot collect taxes. This is a major problem in Brazil. And what does it have to do with content regulation on the internet? Well, I think everything. Because you have to think about the subject from the perspective of non-prohibition and self-regulation. Pornography has always been there, and the internet only empowers its diffusion, just like anything else. Technology is just the intermediary that makes it possible. As you may know, the military dictatorship in Brazil, the government restricted sales of computers in Brazil in the early 80s, sorry. It was not possible to find many computers in Brazil, while in other countries like in Latin America, like Peru, people had broader access to the internet and cyber culture. In the 90s, most of the computers in Brazil were imported with high taxes. Thus, only the upper class had access to computer and cyber culture. In the new century, everybody started to talk about digital inclusion. Personally, I dislike the concept and prefer to use the idea of digital divide. The concept of digital inclusion brings in an idea of salvation, as if middle-class activists had to save the excluded population. And that kind of work is done in a top-down, very patriarchal way. You have other people deciding what is better for you, what kind of content is harmful or not. People in Brazil, people that access public computers in telecentros, infocentros, or in the cultural hotspots in Brazil, mostly these are results of government policies of digital inclusion. They cannot access porn content. And end users' interests are not respected because those kind of policies are top-down and want to save people from their supposed digital ignorance. Thus, the opportunity for self-regulation and critical judgment is not respected or encouraged. At the same time that people cannot access porn on public computers, if you turn on the TV or go to a newspaper stand, you can find vulnerable groups exposed just as if they were animals for sale. The hypocrisy is so great that the most famous Brazilian children's television presenter is a former porn star. And she dresses herself and the children in small tops and shorts and dances provocatively on the morning television. And this is considered acceptable, just like most of the beer advertisement that sells ice cold blondes, an association between the consumption of beer and the consumption of women. The control regulation of access to sexual content on public computers broadens the digital divide that already exists. The digital divide creates a technological elite that will decide for others how the internet will be governed. And this elite is the owners of media companies that decide what kind of content is transmitted. It's people like us who have a privileged space for speech. It's politicians that decide and vote for laws. Of course, there is harmful content on the web, and to access it or not, is that kind of content is up to individuals. At the same time, the internet opened possibilities for oppressed forms of expressions and identities. The question is, will these oppressed forms of expressions be heard by this technological elite? My aspiration as an end user and educator is to promote the debate about self-regulation in end users of public computers from a non-prohibitionist perspective. Thank you.
Thank you very much to everyone for some very thought-provoking presentations. We're going to hold back on Chat's presentation on the APC activities and rather open up the space for some discussion and debate. I'm not going to say very much because I'd like to extend the time for discussion as much as possible, but there are a few questions, a few how questions and what questions that have come up in various presentations. There are questions around the what is pornography, and I think all of the presentations have, or some of the presentations, have highlighted the fact that the whole process of trying to define it is a very fraught process, that it's not a static thing, but it often, discussions around sexuality, etc., are conducted in spaces that are dialogic and interactive. So it's not something that can necessarily be pinned down, but it's also a process that and a set of practices that are socially embedded and are often changing. There's the question of who should be involved in discussions around what is harmful content. So the question is around what is harmful content and who should be involved in discussions around defining what harmful content is. And keeping in mind also Malcolm's point around the fact that often the discussions around or who gets involved in discussions around what is harmful content and trying to define and design self-regulatory processes does attract a particular kind of audience that is more interested in narrowing the space for debate and narrowing the space for an open discussion around issues of what constitutes harmful practices. So there are both pros and cons in the discussion around or opening spaces around self-regulation. But what we want to do in this session is really to capture people's experiences around how we can design processes that are less dependent on legal mechanisms, but are also that also bring in processes that are more interactive, that bring in different viewpoints, and also take into consideration the fact that people have different access to resources. Just drawing on Adriana's example of how class also impacts on people's ability to access content and to be able to interact with content that is challenging heteronormative forms that may be challenging to political regimes, etc. So we want to open up the space so that we can have some discussion about alternative forms of or alternative ways of engaging around notions of harmful content and setting up some participatory ways of defining how we go about creating standards that are context-specific and that take into account local norms and values. So with that, I want to open it up to the floor for discussion and feedback and responses from the panelists. Any questions, any comments?
Yes, so my name is Daria, I'm coming from Russia. Of course, there is a number of social problems which require state regulation. As I said, there is a suicide, and each state has to have a policy to decrease the suicide rate. There is prostitution, there is drug traffic, and so on. And of course, internet should not be avoided without the state regulation in a term. We all agree that it is different to regulate internet because of its international nature. Still, some attempts has to be done. And the nations are just in the very beginning of thinking out how these problems can be regulated. Of course, as you said correctly, prohibition is not always the way. No, perhaps one of possible other ways of regulating and intervening could be an analog of social work, having some kind of social workers talking to dangerous groups online. For example, a psychologist could enter a community of suicide clubbers and try to convince them to behave otherwise. I'm unfortunately not very much aware about practices of regulating social problems in the internet. So I just would like to hear the experience from you. But I think that in the future, in the meetings of the United Nations, these problems should take more and more place. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else?
Perhaps then I could add a question to the speaker. So what did you mean when you told that regulation or intervention should not necessarily be prohibitive?
If I understood you right, your question is, what did I mean by saying regulation is not automatically prohibition? Is
yes,
this?
What are the forms of regulation?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I was trying to say that the state is not reduced to regulation, and especially as we saw, for example, from this quoted court decision, there is seen, meanwhile, this change of paradigm of the role of the state to be active in another sense than just regulation. Active means that, for example, the state cannot only be passive and says, well, everybody has the right of not interference from the state, but the understanding of human rights and constitutional rights often goes also in the direction the state must be active for its citizens to have the possibility to fulfill its rights. And what is this, for example? This is, as I said, for example, this question of giving all the skills for empowerment. That, for example, you start at a very early age to teach children of becoming familiarized with ICT technologies, to teach them what is, let's say, the big, not only danger, but from a positive side, the positive challenge that they face. For example, that everybody at a very early stage can become creative, can become a producer, and at the same time has to learn how to cope with the problem that he becomes responsible then. Yesterday we had an interesting workshop, I think, about protecting children on the internet. And one of the interesting points where when we want to protect children from harm, it's always the question, which harm? Is it only the harm that adults offer, so to speak, to children? Or are there also other harms, for example, from other children to children? When you look at YouTube or MySpace and so on, a high quantity of the visual, audiovisual content there is produced by very young people for their friends, for their classmates and so on. And they very often show their classmates in situations where, well, you really can ask the question of dignity of those people shown. They show them drunk, they show them as hostages of brutality from other classmates and so on. And these pictures go around the world. I want to stress, I don't think that the state should intervene here because it's a question of morality, but what the state has to do by, let's say, its educational system, really to teach children what are human rights, what is freedom of expression, not only from the side of liberty, but also from the side of responsibility. So this would be one action. Another action apart from regulation is, of course, this close context with, let's say, industry when it comes to self-regulation or to filtering. When I say self-regulation, maybe a contradiction, because when I say self-regulation, it should not be a space for the state. But in Europe, for example, we follow a system that is called co-regulation. What does it mean? It means the state gives a certain framework for self-regulation For example, in one point that was mentioned before, the question of transparency of self-regulation systems. What are the minimum standards that you can speak about the so-called self-regulation systems, which would, for example, mean that everybody who wants of this certain, for example, industry, who wants to be part of the self-regulation system, must have the right to participate. So certain minimum standards by the state, and then maybe the state can then intervene if the self-regulation system fails. So I would say this is also not classical regulation, but there are other forms and other alternatives how the state can be active, and that's what I wanted to express. I hope that was a little bit clearer. Thank you.
Question over there.
It's okay. Yes, thank you. Mark Kelly, also from the Council of Europe. I just wanted to follow up on that a little bit and think about the situation where harmful content actually spills over into physical harm to people and violence and so on. And I think it's very interesting that this particular event is taking that beyond the realm of child abuse, which is where that's usually discussed, and looking in particular at ways in which violence to women can result from harmful content of various sorts. And I just wanted to pick up on what Matthias was saying and to stress that in other areas, the Council of Europe is trying to expand the notion of there being a positive and proactive duty on the state to act in circumstances of that sort. Back in 2002, as long ago as that, the Committee of Ministers adopted a recommendation on the protection of women against violence, and it actually spells out in terms an obligation on the state to exercise due diligence to prevent, investigate, and punish acts of violence. And interestingly, it adds, whether those acts are perpetrated by the state or private persons, and to provide protection for victims. And I think it's important in such a technologically charged environment that we don't lose sight of the more basic standards that have also been developed and ways in which organizations like the Council of Europe are trying to recalibrate things so that the state is seen to have a positive duty to act when it's confronted by facts and circumstances of that sort. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In the middle.
Raoul Faber, University of Zurich, Switzerland. I would like to draw on Michael's intervention made just before, because somehow, surprisingly enough, the term co-regulation appeared only in the discussion and not in the presentations. And I think co-regulation, at least in Europe, is quite a common approach to somehow tackle problems of internet regulation in general. And there are, of course, two sides of the medal. The one side is who is going to regulate what. The backside of the medal is who is going to enforce what. And I think we should also talk a little bit about enforcement. And insofar, I would see a certain possibility that states are somehow delegating, of course, within a specific framework, some enforcement duties to the ISPs, because it's of course nice to say from the ISP side we do not want to get involved into the enforcement matters. However, to a certain extent at least, ISPs are the gatekeepers. For them it's the most easiest way to combat harmful content, and as long as governance states are giving a legal framework, I would not see a legal problem to delegate a certain part of the enforcement power to private enterprises. But of course, I'm wondering how the panel is reacting to such kind of approach.
Let's take another question and then have a response.
Yeah.
I have to ask a question on behalf of my colleague who was supposed to come here, but he was not denied Brazilian visa. So, yes, it was in Tanzania. So, let's return to pornography, and the question perhaps is to a feminist representation. In overwhelming majority of countries, pornography is considered, if not harmful, but then a special content. And it's not available freely, and there are certain limitations. But why do we have on the internet pornography available just by clicking? So his idea was to suggest the United Nations to make all pornography paid by credit cards. In this case, child access to pornography would be strongly limited. So what do you think of this idea?
Okay, we'll have Matthias respond to the question put to him directly, and then Chat will respond to.
Yes, thank you. I mean, the question, of course, who regulates what in a system of co-regulation, and where is, let's say, the reinforcement? This is, of course, the key question that is always posed when you have a mixed system of industry regulation and state regulation. I would say, self-regulation and co-regulation never can be a complete delegation of state responsibility. There must be a final accountability of the state if a system does not work, if there is really obvious threat to vulnerable groups in society. But that's exactly what also the European Court of Human Rights always say when interpreting the Convention on Human Rights. It says there must be an urgent, pressing need for state intervention, which means that if there is not this urgent, pressing need, the court and the understanding of the Convention on Human Rights as regards freedom of speech, especially, is the way that there should be alternatives than an let's say, real intervention of the state by regulation. Nonetheless, to be more practical, I'm quite convinced that the topic, what does self-regulation really mean and what does co-regulation really mean, needs much more discussion in international fora. I remember very well about 10 years ago I was in a big meeting, I was in a meeting of a big German media producer, I won't quote who it was, but they made a big event on self-regulation, and the whole event, from my impression, was some kind of don't touch us at all with our new technologies, states and whoever, politicians, and leave us alone. And our miracle word is self-regulation. And also in legal texts now, also of the European Union, but also in the Council of Europe, we incline saying often, well, self-regulation is the solution. And also today on this forum, it was said, well, self-regulation. I fully agree that self-regulation as such has really an important role to play in this context. But what is still missing is really some kind of at least minimum understanding what this self-regulation really means. And there I think the state has a certain role and responsibility, for example, to guarantee if there is self-regulation that this self-regulation system really works in an equivalent manner for those who want to participate. So to care, so to provide for transparency systems, to provide for equal access to the self-regulation systems and so on. And finally, come back to your question, I think if there is the obvious proof that the self-regulation system does not work, and there are, of course, then obvious dangers to public goods, then the state finally has to have the accountability. Thank you.
I'd like to respond to that in the context of self-regulation and harmful content. I think the previous question mentioned that harmful content leads to violence. And in fact, I think that's where there is a lot of debate on. It's not only what is harmful content, does it actually lead to violence? There's been many, many different researches around that, especially in the context of violence against women. And this is where I want to draw on the point around self-regulation or co-regulation or whatever standards we want to look at, is that the significance here is that there is pornography, there is sexually explicit content, but there's also violence. And there are, I think we need to differentiate, there's differences in that. And there are international standards, conventions already acceptable in different countries around what is violence, what constitutes violence against women, for example, in the context. And that has to come into the discussion when we look at what then, how do we look at self-regulation? And that, then I'd come back to the question of pornography. The practice at the moment is that you can actually buy pornography online. You can buy pornography. There's 2% in the internet. The data is that there's 2% the pornography is 2% of overall web content, but it's very visible because it's marketed. A lot of this is marketed very, very aggressively. Some of that definitely it leads to violence. The point about pornography that a lot of the women's organizations, for example, try to bring attention to is pornography or content that in fact eroticizes violence against women. And that is the basis of saying then that, you know, that it is harmful. Because it eroticizes rape, it eroticizes murder of women, and it makes it sexual, it makes it, and it feeds on that. So there's also, I mean, when you talk about definition of harmful content, I think those, that has to come into the discussion. And it's something that we've been trying to work on and to involve women organizations that work on domestic violence, for example, organizations that work on looking at rape, etc. And a lot of that now you can find content on the internet.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up on the credit card idea, because it's an interesting issue that raises some points that have actually come up in the real world and we have actually experienced. This was actually touched upon by the Perrin case that Matthias referred to earlier. And as a quick nutshell, what happened in that case, the website provider who was selling pornography was prosecuted in the United Kingdom. It was not child pornography, but he was prosecuted on the claim that this material was so extreme that it offended against criminal standards of obscenity within the United Kingdom. The way that the case resolved itself was that he was acquitted with respect to the material that he sold by credit card, because the credit card was said to be proved that it was being sold to adults. But he was convicted of a criminal offense in respect of the material that was on display before it was purchased, because the theory that that material was capable of being seen and would be seen by children. And therefore it met the standard of criminal obscenity when that material was made available to children. So we now have a situation where all the legal advice in the United Kingdom is that if you require somebody to show a credit card before you show them the pornography, then you're in the clear. But if you make it freely available, then you are subject to prosecution. Now, of course, that means that while pornography is freely available online from within the United Kingdom, none of it's hosted within the United Kingdom. So it doesn't actually achieve anything very much. But supposing that it did, supposing everybody adopted that standard, I think this comes back to what I was saying about the changing effects of the intermediated society. Because yes, you're right to say that before the internet, there was less, pornography was less readily available, less widely available. It was very often only available from limited distribution points that were relatively controlled. But the entrance to those, the access to those limited points was not so controlled. You could go and gain that pornography often without identifying yourselves. But by requiring it to go through a credit card check, you're saying that pornography is only going to be accessible to those that choose to identify themselves and is not to be made available anonymously. So in a sense, if we adopt this standard, we are actually having a reduction in the availability of the material compared with the previous offline context, which is quite counterintuitive compared to what we actually see where it is freely available online, where it's much more readily available. This raises a more general point that I think we are seeing debated in all the child protection discussions, which is, should we make the default position on the internet that it is safe for children? This is a contention that is raised widely by those that claim to be speaking in the name of child protection, to make the internet safe for children. This is a paradigm conflict, I would say. There is a conflict here between a traditional view that would see the parents as the principal regulators of what the children see and access and what they should do, and that it is their duty and their responsibility to regulate their children's access to the internet or to anything else. And essentially the principal regulator with regard to children is the parents, and the state only steps in when the parents are plainly incompetent at that, or when they are malicious, when there is something wrong. But the make everything by default safe for children is another paradigm. It sees the experts as the regulator of what is available by default online and in the name of child protection. And then the adult space within the internet is then just a privilege that if you can prove that you are an adult and are willing to identify yourself as such and willing to identify yourself generally, then you can have access to the privileged space of being allowed to participate as an adult. But otherwise, you'll be subject by default to the kind of conditions that the experts have deemed to be suitable for children. That is a paradigm conflict that I think we're going to see played out in the discussions here and elsewhere on an ongoing basis, and I think it's one we should pay real attention to.
We're at two, and we're meant to close the session. So I'm going to take the two questions, but I also wanted to pose a question to Adriana. Having raised the issue of class and access to resources in order to access internet content that may be that is controversial and for which the government wants to regulate and regulate access to, what would you say are some of the ways in which you want to see communities, poor communities, indigenous communities, women, etc., participate in the discussions around defining what harmful content might be, but also in responding to some of the emerging practices that Malcolm has just talked about, and the use of credit cards particularly?
Well, just I'll start from the credit card thing, because it's very interesting. You can have access to anything you want on the internet. If you don't have a credit card, you have peer-to-peer, you have Kazaa, Emuli, whatever. If you prohibit something, then there will always be a hacker to make that available. That's just the way it works on the internet. Internet is like militaries and hackers. And it's kind of fucked up. You can't avoid that. So, here in Brazil, we have lots of children going to LAN houses, because in the LAN houses, they can go there, they can access porn, they can play, because they are paying for that. So they are not going to the public telecentros because it's supposedly to be educational, and they don't have access to that kind of stuff. So they go and they spend money paying to do that. They are going to get wherever they want. So when you are in a cultural hotspot, which involves a community, and there are different examples about debates inside. There are cultural hotspots that simply block the access of people to harmful content. I don't know what you mean about harmful content, because something can be harmful for me and are not harmful for you. I mean, I don't know about the crazy ideas of people, but there are people that like to see others being beaten. I mean, I don't like that. That's harmful for me, but that cannot be harmful for people that like that. You know, it's a question of respect, kind of, for different tastes. And in some cultural hotspots, very few, as a matter of fact, they started to debate about the children. And the main argument was that, oh, you are using a computer to see porn or to use Orkut or play a game, while other people could be here studying or doing a paper for school. So, like, you're using a public computer for a not educational purposes. And it's very complicated. It's very complicated. I don't know the answer about that. I think you should talk to people, especially young people, because they are interested in seeing pornography, and they love or could. If you just, it's like, it's why I did, I talked about drugs before. It's just like, when you have a kid and it's 14 years old, they want to smoke marijuana. If you say no, marijuana will kill you, and that's very harmful for you, they just get more curious, you know? It's just like, if you say no, don't do that, don't see pornography, it's not good, it's bad. And for children, I don't know, children do have sexuality. The big issue is that who produces content that talks about sexuality for children? It's adults. That's why it's harmful, kind of harmful for them. Because if they were able to produce content that talked about their sexuality, that would be different. I mean, might not be harmful for them, you know? I don't know. So I think the way is like talk. I mean, we don't talk to children about sex in school, so how do we expect them to be open to talk about that? They are going on the backs of their parents in somebody's houses to see a very, in my opinion, harmful porn content, because the porn content is made for a taste that is not mine. It's made mostly, the industry of porn is, it's a white heterosexual male taste. But they are going to access only that because that's the only thing that's available. So, I don't know.
Okay. Well,
make one very quick point?
Sure.
Some of the points that you've just made there are very liberal and many people would find quite challenging. But on the nature of harmful content, I would like to draw attention to that one area of that is said to be harmful is that places vulnerable groups at risk, and particularly children as the principal vulnerable group at risk. And so within UK, if your ISP is the mobile phone company and you try and access a chat room, you cannot do so, or at least you cannot do so if it's a chat room they found, because they will block access to the chat rooms until you prove that you are an adult and therefore get the block lifted so that you have access to this privileged adult space. On the grounds that the mere act of chat between people without moderation, without somebody supervising it, places the children at risk. And so it's not just pornography, it's not just people beating people up. Mere communication between people per se is said to be a risk to vulnerable groups, and therefore something that should be controlled and potentially people should be excluded from until they have been proven to be adults.
I can only take about two questions, I think. So there was a question there at the back that was earlier, and I'll take yours, yeah.
I have to admit, I don't have a question. I just wanted to say my name is Imme Pate. I come from the FSM, the German Organization for Self and Co-Regulation. And I think I can say that our work is quite successful. However, we still face the problem that in Germany, not the whole of German industry is willing to work together with us. Yes, if somebody is interested in the German experience on co-regulation, please feel free to contact me. Thank you.
My name is Tarek Shinintian from Oxford University. My question is a very practical one. There's now a proliferation of virtual environments on the internet on which you can do all kinds of activities. Second Life is a good example of that. And you can do, amongst other things, virtual harmful things like killing someone virtually, raping someone virtually. My question is this something you can govern? Is this something that we should govern? And if so, how?
Are you asking your question to anybody in particular, or
anyone who can answer me?
Okay. All right, we should be closing, so I'm going to ask each of those who feel that they want to respond to the question to do so, and also make a concluding remark. Yes? So let's start with you, Mithat.
Just to a direct answer, yes, you can govern if you do not mean govern as a synonym always for regulating. Govern means to have responsibility, and of these alternatives that I was speaking, yes, you can, but I'm convinced not by regulation, for example, to do a regulation on Second Life or something like that. Thank you.
I guess for me, the point that I would like to stress is around, yes, there are a lot of issues around child pornography, but that the content regulation affects not only children, it affects all of society, and that when we talk of vulnerable groups, I don't want to really think of women as vulnerable groups, but women have their own agency, and they are concerned about these issues, and that their participation in defining what should be available and how it should be, what kinds of practices would in fact empower them in terms of their expression, their own sexuality, their own, is very important. And that if it is about regulation, there are in fact existing regulation standards, etc., that looks at already responds to issues where violence is eroticized, and that needs to come into the discussion. And one of the things that we are doing, in fact, is trying to address that through some of the in an awareness raising and educational campaigns, where we are looking at online content, trying to identify how we can use information technologies to respond to violence against women. We have our leaflets there. I'd like you to invite you to look at it. From November 25th to December 10, we have a campaign. And this is a global campaign that looks at how do you stop violence against women. And we're trying to look at organize a campaign around net actions. What do you do? How do you look at that? Bringing stories, bringing information around all those issues. And I'd like to end there.
Okay, I don't know how to answer him.
Just final comments or the response you wanted to make to Malcolm?
It was kind of what she said, because you put women as a vulnerable group sometimes, and nowadays you have like women producing porn, that it's not harmful for them. So
I think that's a very fair point to criticize the claim of vulnerable group, but to be honest, in many respects, I would criticize vulnerable group being applied to children in some circumstances as well. It's a point about language. The term vulnerable group is a tool that is used by people seeking certain policy prescriptions. And so however valid or invalid it may be in a given case, it is there for a purpose. To answer the gentleman's question about what we should do about it all, well, that's a very big question. I think we can only say that the response must vary, and it will vary according to the circumstances. At one end of the spectrum, we heard about the case of Lambdamoo, the text adventure, the text environment. Now, without denigrating the real sense of violation that I'm sure those people felt, I feel quite comfortable with the idea that exclusion from that community by that community is a satisfactory and complete response to that kind of situation. But at the other end of the spectrum, probably the most horrific thing I can think of is the ongoing examples of children that are raped to order on webcam for the satisfaction of the people watching the webcam. Now, mere exclusion from some online community is by no means a satisfactory response to that. I get very illiberal when I think about that. I think that such people, the only satisfactory response must be a law enforcement response. Such people who do that should be made to feel the full might and majesty of the law, and somewhere in between according to the different circumstances. As a concluding remark, I would say that it is therefore important within this to think about what the proper roles and responsibilities for the various actors in this can be. And speaking on behalf of the kind of companies that I represent, that will vary according to what they are. If they're operating an online community, then they can have one form of response. If they are a hosting company, then certainly the removal of illegal material is a potential response, or is an appropriate response. And similarly, a potential response if they're a search engine to remove the link to such material. That's one way of doing it. If they are merely carrying the traffic, I would strongly caution against looking for the person who is merely carrying the traffic, and instead say that you should be directing response to the ends of that, to who is hosting it, who is providing it, who is actively involved in it, rather than seeking to make the network itself a tool to leverage to control action.
I think the next session people are already coming in. I want to thank all the presenters for their inputs and for a very interesting discussion, also with the participation of yourselves. This is an issue on which there will be continued discussion as we try to find solutions that kind of match the need and the inclinations in different social cultural contexts. So I'm going to leave it at that, as I'm getting distracted by all the movement. And thank you again. Thank you.